Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate and organize around the eco-socialist platform that Angela Walker and I ran on in 2020. So I'm going to talk about a number of topics this week, because next week I have a guest that I want to just get right to. It's Rafael Bernabe. He's a member of the Puerto Rican Senate, elected from the third party Progressive Citizens Victory Movement. And he's going to talk about Puerto Rico, Ukraine, and from an eco-socialist perspective. And so that I'm not going to make any comments next week. We're going to go right to Rafael. But today, first thing I want to again bring people's attention to is this petition we're circulating urging the United Nations General Assembly to authorize UN peacekeeping forces to demilitarize and secure the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power complex, where there's a real crisis going on. The latest news is that the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors there found mines on the perimeter of the complex, but they've still not been allowed to look at the roofs of the reactors 3 and 4, where there's new objects up there. It's not clear what they are. Ukrainian intelligence is worried that they're explosives, and then inside the reactor halls, they haven't been in there. And I don't know, I haven't found news on it, but you know, the storage pool for water, which cools the reactor, and the storage ponds for about 2,200 of the 5,500 spent nuclear fuel rods there. You know, Ukrainian intelligence says that they think the pool may have been mined, the reservoir. And so, you know, that should be checked out. So, you know, the idea is that this resolution would be could be supported by many of the 35 countries that abstained from the resolutions condemning Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. And that would create, you know, such a broad international political pressure on Russia that then they might agree to remove their forces and let the UN forces take over and just demilitarize and secure that plant so nothing catastrophic happens. The precedent for that is it wouldn't go through the UN Security Council because Russia would veto it. But the UN General Assembly has taken upon itself, they did this in 1950, the power to act when the Security Council won't. And the last time they did this was 1956. Israel, France, and the UK were invading Egypt to take control of the Suez Canal, which Egypt had nationalized. And in that case, you know, the US, then the Soviet Union, and China, at that time it was Taiwan, who was ceded, I believe. In any case, you know, they overrode the veto of France and Britain, who were permanent members of the Security Council, and sent a peacekeeping force there. And Israel, France, and Britain backed off, and they stopped their invasion. So it has worked before, and that's what we're hoping for. So that petition should be in the chat, a link to it. And then there was a Counterpunch article that I and other anti-nuclear activists like Harvey Wassman and Carl Grossman and Dennis Bondar put in there, basically, you know, giving, it's a short article explaining why we need to, you know, get the UN in there and the Russian troops out from the nuclear site. So that link will be in the chat. So take a look at that. It's a short article. So one thing that happened this week is the Fed again raised interest rates. I think it's 5.5%, highest it's been since the 90s, you know, that's decades. And, you know, the reason you would raise interest rates is to, you know, slow down wage price inflation, you know, induce unemployment so wages can come down or freeze. And then, you know, prices don't have to increase because companies are paying more for wages. That kind of circle driving inflation is not what has been happening. You know, what we've had is because of COVID supply shortages, and when you have short supply, you know, demand raises the prices. But those have been resolving, at least in the competitive sectors. So a real anti-inflation policy would focus on increasing supply, making sectors where you have shared monopolies more competitive, so they compete on the basis of price. And really, I mean, this is where the Green New Deal would be great, because it would increase supply of renewable energy and then require a whole lot of ancillary industries to make the whole transition. Instead, we got these neoliberal dummies in the Fed deliberately decreasing consumption. You know, housing and consumer loans are going to be more expensive, and thus increasing unemployment. Right now, historically, Black community unemployment has been about double of the white community unemployment. It's now at 6%. It could go up to 8 or 10% with this rate hike. It's just callous. And these are dogmatic ideologues at best, or they're just class warriors for the rich. But the Fed is just not doing us a service with this rate hike. And, you know, with the Congress we got, there's not any movement to push back, except, you know, a few people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren correctly calling out the Fed, but they don't have any control over it. And then another issue that's, you know, really bugging me is, you know, what the governor of Texas has done with putting buoys wrapped in razor wire, telling, Border Patrol to not provide water to people in all that heat. You know, these are crimes against humanity. And so what's the Biden administration do? It sues. The Border Patrol, first of all, immigration is a federal responsibility, federal law obtains, and Biden is in charge of the Border Patrol and immigration and customs enforcement. And instead, he's suing Texas instead of telling his people that are supposed to be working for him to tell the Texas Rangers or whoever is enforcing the Texas policy to back off. Instead, they're going to court. And of course, that's going to take a long time. Meanwhile, we've had people cut by the razor wire. People have drowned. They're being pushed back into the river. I mean, it's not just, you know, adult males. It's mothers. There's a pregnant woman caught in that razor wire. A child of a 4 years old drowned. I mean, this is terrible. And then, you know, there's news this week also that there are Afghan people in Pakistan who worked with, you know, U.S., whether it was military or humanitarian aid, that don't feel safe with the Taliban in power. They went across the border, as the U.S. told them, into Pakistan. And it's been 2 years, and they can't get their applications for asylum processed. The U.S. is just not putting the resources in. It's, again, callous disregard. And we're 2 years later, and now Pakistan's saying we've had enough of these people and starting to force them back into Afghanistan. So, you know, the rhetoric may have toned down since Trump, but the policies, this just, you know, cruel treatment of immigrants and migrants under Biden is as bad as it was under Trump. And, you know, that's why we need a Green Party, you know, to bring a humane immigration policy to the fore. I was actually talking with a Green Party candidate, you know, talking through some of these issues this week, who's running for federal office. And hopefully that person will be able to, you know, raise that issue in her campaign. And it's something I wish we had more Greens out there running to do. And then we've talked about the Mountain Valley Pipeline each of the last 2 weeks. First, we got a court decision from the appeals court to stop construction because it violated some protected land. And then the Biden administration and the companies building it sued in the Supreme Court. And a lot of times it takes a long time. Supreme Court very quickly overturned the appellate division ruling, the circuit court ruling. And so now the pipeline can be constructed. And, you know, there's nobody else to appeal to beyond the Supreme Court. But there are other ways to continue fighting this. And one of them is the battle shifts to trying to stop the fracking in Pennsylvania and Ohio that will feed this pipeline. And in that case, it's not the Democrats or Republicans, it's only the Green Party that's calling for an end of fracking, as well as all new fossil fuel infrastructure. So again, that's why we need the Green Party. And the other thing is building out renewables so the fossil gas isn't needed. And the Mountain Valley Pipeline ends up being a wasted investment. What do they call it? Some kind of elephant? Forget the phrase, but the metaphor. But anyway, that can still happen. And we're seeing signs of that. You know, there's this big proposed $44 billion fossil gas pipeline from the North Shore of Alaska to Alaska's southern ports. And that gas they're trying to sell to particularly Asian markets like Japan and South Korea. But investors in those countries don't want to invest in it because they think renewables are going to take over before they'll need that gas. And the Biden administration is supporting it, but it too hasn't agreed to the loan guarantees that the proponents of this, which include the Alaska legislature and their federal delegation and their governor, want. But the point is, if we can remove the demand for that fossil gas, then the Mountain Valley Pipeline will be a boondoggle, not a problem for the climate. And speaking of growing renewables, we got a report that was spun as optimistic from the Rocky Mountain Institute, which does a lot of energy work. And it projects that 1/3 of the world's energy will be produced by renewables by 2030. And that's an increase of 3 to 4 times the current renewable energy capacity. But is that really good news? I mean, not so much. We need to be close to 100% renewables by 2030, certainly in the production of electricity, if we're going to have any chance of stemming off really catastrophic climate change. And it's just market forces that are expanding renewables because they're cheaper. They're cheaper than the alternatives, whether it's nuclear or various fossil fuels. But to get to 100% on a fast pace, like a decade, is going to require public ownership and planning, because a lot of these utilities, they have gas-fired plants, for example, and they don't want to mothball those until they're worn out, which could be decades from now. Whereas we do it under public ownership and planning, the goal is not profit, but service and need at cost. And you can cross-subsidize, so you can shut down the coal and gas-fired plants as you bring in the renewables. And over time, you'll get paid back because people will be paying for that renewable energy. So that's possible, but not under a profit-oriented system. And the Rocky Mountain Institute doesn't even say how much these renewables are going to be replacing fossil fuels as opposed to adding to them, which is a big problem. We are building renewable capacity, but we're not shutting down corresponding amounts of fossil and nuclear fuel capacity. And again, that's why we need a Green New Deal with social ownership and democratic planning to make this happen on the time scale we need to. If we wait for the market and little incentives that, you know, corporate welfare and consumer incentives that mostly go to the upscale people anyway to buy cars that, you know, like electric vehicles that most of us can't afford anyway, even with the credits, if that's all we do, we're not going to do it in time. And then, you know, the climate crisis this week, it's getting scary. There was another study out that said that this, I forget the formal name for it, but there's a current that, you know, goes from the Indian Ocean and under the sea, and it ends up just south of Greenland, where it's been on the surface, and then it goes down and goes back. And what it does is bring warm water up to the North Atlantic, which keeps Europe warm for its latitude. And this current, you know, the scientists believe that it has shut down just before previous ice ages. So, you know, the concern is this thing, and the study said it's certainly going to shut down by the end of the century, but it could shut down as soon as 2 years from now, given their measurements. I mean, that's really scary. I mean, what it'll do to Europe is it'll make its climate more like Calgary, in Canada. You know, very cold. It's going to cut their food production. But that'll be exception because the rest of the planet will keep heating up. And then another thing that seems to happen when this current shuts down is that methane hydrates that are frozen at the bottom of the sea, they're kind of like snow cone slurry, will start melting and we'll get a methane bomb. And of course, methane is far more potent as a greenhouse gas, about 80 to 85 times more potent over its first 20 years in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. So we could get a methane bomb when this thing, this current shuts down. I mean, what we're looking at is tipping points that trigger more tipping points. And we get an accelerating climate crisis that will be, you know, even harder to slow down and hopefully, you know, turn back. I mean, the optimistic scenario is we can stop emitting the greenhouse gases and then through things like reforestation, wetlands, and various other natural ways of sequestering the carbon in the earth or in the biosphere, we can bring the amount of carbon in the atmosphere back down to a level below 350 parts per million, you know, 350.org. You know, James Hansen, the climate scientist here in the United States, suggested that was the maximum safe threshold, although the other climate scientists say it should be at least below 300. You look historically, we've had, you know, melting of the ice caps at 280 parts per million, which is what we had at the beginning of the industrial age. Other things were in play in those earlier, you know, warming periods, you know, related to, you know, the tipping of the planet in relation to the Earth and how close we were to it. So, but you, the hope is, we, you know, by sequestering, you know, carbon dioxide or carbon back into the earth or the living organisms, the biosphere, you know, rebuilding the soil and those kinds of things, we can bring carbon down and bring the temperature back down. But the things that, you know, the studies I've cited are saying, you know, we might get beyond the point of no return or make it much more harder to return. So, you know, this climate crisis is very serious. It's existential. And, you know, if you follow the rest of the news, it's all about Trump and his, you know, further indictments, you know, and is Biden too old? But you don't hear a debate or a call for climate action from the major party candidates. I mean, goddamn, Robert Kennedy was repeating some, you know, right-wing stuff about this being a hoax, like he was Donald Trump. It's crazy. I mean, I'm just a retired Teamster, and I'm wondering, you know, how do we get these dummies in positions where, you know, they're talking crazy on the media and talking about stuff that's not relevant when we have a climate crisis? Oh, man, it's just... you know, all we can do is organize and speak out and keep going, which brings me to the last thing I wanted to talk about. Being a retired UPS Teamster, you know, the contract agreement was announced by the company and the bargaining unit of the Teamsters, and they are sending it to the rank and file to vote on over the next month. Rank and file is looking at it, so. You know, I thought I'd put some of this contract in perspective. When I first tried to work at UPS, it was in 1972, the wage was $10 an hour. And there was no distinction between part-time and full-time workers. They didn't have different tiers. $10 an hour in 1972, I didn't get the job. They even had me take a physical, but I kept trying. I never could get that job. It was my dream job because I could have afforded college on that, although I had been drafted that year and, you know, other things were complicating life. But anyway, I wanted that job so bad, and I never did get it back then. $10 an hour in 1972 is $73 today, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics inflation calculator. Now, what happened was, and this was the whole attack on working people that began in that 1973-4 recession, and continued. And, you know, the business council formed and the trilateral commission formed, and they went on the offensive. You may have heard of the Powell memo. Lewis Powell wrote it to the Chamber of Commerce saying that, you know, we're losing, we being the ruling class, are losing control. Now we go and talk to Black people and women and environmentalists, and Ralph Nader is the worst of them. He's causing us all kinds of problems. And so he stimulated an offensive on the part of capital against labor. And, you know, the Teamsters at that time were mobbed up and they were corrupted. And so in 1982, there was a terrible concessionary contract that cut the starting wage to $8. They cut the wage and they set up this two-tier pay scale between part-time and full-time, even if they're doing the same work. The drivers, you know, didn't get hit so bad. They had their differential with the part-timers was about three times. They were paid about three times more at that time. And then UPS just started hiring nothing but part-timers. And that led to speed up in terms of what was going on in the hub. You know, people unloading trucks and loading trucks and sorting them in between. The whole operation sped up because they could work people to the bone and they'd walk away exhausted after 3 or 4 hours instead of, you know, having to pace themselves over an 8-hour shift. So that happened. And then, you know, there was the resistance. The Teamsters for the Democratic Union formed and they won in 1991 the right for the rank and file to vote on the election of the president instead of having, you know, the union leaders in each local meeting a convention and do it. So that led to the election of Ron Kerry, who, you know, did want to fight back and he wasn't corrupt. But, you know, he faced problems. In 1994, they increased the package weight limit from 70 to 150 pounds. The company did that unilaterally. There was some strike action, but most of the locals didn't follow what the national wanted, which convinced Kerry he's got to organize. And so he started focusing on the 1997 contract. And there was a 2-week strike that year. It was the biggest strike and the most impactful strike in probably the last 50 years. And we won a lot of stuff. The starting wage for part-timers didn't go up like it should have. It went up to $8.50. And when I finally got a job at UPS in a whole nother era in 2001, I started at $8.50. which is about $14.80, almost $15 today. The starting wage today is $15.50. It did go up during the pandemic because so many people were getting sick and or quitting. And there was a lot more volume. So there's a lot more work, forced overtime. People were just couldn't hack it. So the pay got up for, you know, people starting there up to $18. But then when things got back more back to normal by in early 2022, they cut it back, you know, so people were back to, you know, $15.50 who were starting out. So in this temporary agreement that's being voted on, they're going to immediately raise for the part-timers the wage to $21 from $15.50. That's a pretty big jump, and the part-timers are going to like that. And it'll go pretty slowly over 5 years to $23. Now, the union was demanding $25. And when they walked out on negotiations, when the company walked out on July 5th, you know, the last thing to deal with was wages. And so I always felt the company was come back. They got plenty of money, over $100 billion in profits last year. They could pay higher wages and they come back with the offer. And they came back, they met them halfway from 21 and between 21 and 25 is 23. And the union accepted that. I mean, I think at 21, when I was working there, it took me 18 years to get to $21 an hour. And the top driver's rate, even today, is 49. And that's still way below the 73 they were getting paid in real dollars in 1972. So the union did win a lot. There were two tiers for drivers. They got that eliminated. They got mandatory 6-day work weeks for delivery drivers eliminated. Mandatory time eliminated, overtime eliminated. UPS will add 7,500 full-time jobs. I'm not impressed. There's 340,000 people working at UPS. and the majority are part-timers. So, you know, there's progress, but not much. In all this heat, they won that they'll put air conditioning in the vans, but only the new vans. It's going to take them 15 years to replace the current fleet. But, in the, you know, very soon they're going to put fans in there and do some other venting and shielding to so the engine heat isn't heating up inside the cabin so much. So those were advances, although they could have been faster. A big one, and a lot of people are surprised the company surrendered on this, is they're installing driver-facing cameras. So the, you know, the supervisor sitting back at the hub could watch every damn move you make, who you're talking to, you know, all kinds of things. If you need to go take a pee, you know, the fact that you weren't working, they'll see that. It's, you know, that was something the drivers hated, but the company loved, and the union won that. And then they got a paid holiday for Martin Luther King Day, which, you know, most companies had. So that's a victory. So I think the rank and file is going to vote this through. Just to tell you a little bit more about what was going on there, because during COVID, I know in the hub that I used to work in, just about everybody got it. They didn't do masking, wasn't required. They didn't do contact tracing. The company said that would violate HIPAA, which is protecting your privacy of your medical records. But, you know, if you're in a work area and somebody was working in there and they end up, you know, not there the next day because of COVID, you'd like to know that so you can get yourself tested. So that's why, you know, COVID spread through there and they ended up with a labor shortage. And that's why there were those raises. But I think, like I said, the contract will be voted through because the part-timers aren't organized. They tend to, you know, do the part-time job because of health and pension benefits, mostly health, because most of them don't plan to be around long enough to get a decent pension. And so often they don't vote. It's the full-timers that pay more attention, and they always get a little bit better deal than the part-timers. So I think it's likely. You know, in a way, it's too bad, because when labor doesn't exercise its strike muscle, it atrophies. And if they had had a strike, even a demonstration strike, even during the tentative agreement, you know, the workers would feel more like they want it. Now, the Secretary General or Secretary Treasurer, Sean O'Brien, is going to be the guy saying, I got you the contract. So, you know, it's not the rank and file mobilized, it's reliance on this guy who was a Hoffa guy who did a lot of those concessionary contracts that we had in the 2000s, but got pissed when in the last contract in 2018, and I was there for that, we voted it down, but it wasn't a two-thirds vote down. So there was a provision in the Constitution where, you know, they could force it down our throats, and they did that. And Sean O'Brien was mad with that. Second in charge, Fred Zimmerman, was already mad at that because they'd done that to his hub in Lexington, Kentucky, where all the Amazon packages go through. Very big hub. Not all the Amazon, but a lot of them. So that's how they got pushed into the opposition. So the energy and the labor movement, I think, is with the white-collar workers, the services, which are low wage, and the better paid, highly educated professional sectors, nurses, teachers, the entertainment professionals. That's where the energy is. The industrial workers, we had the railroad workers strike blocked by Biden and the Democrats earlier this year. The longshoremen and warehouse, ILWU, International Longshore and Warehouse Union, they're currently working without a contract and not striking. Up in Vancouver, they are, but in the U.S., they're not. And, you know, it looks like, you know, they're coming close to a deal, and they're just going to work it out without a strike. And then we got the UAW, new inexperienced leadership, and there would be reasons for the, you know, auto workers to strike, but, you know, the new leadership is not likely to want to do that. They're just getting in there. So that's kind of the state of the labor movement. The one thing I'll say finally about this contract is, it does set a much higher standard, and UPS already had it, than similar workers doing the same kinds of jobs that Amazon and FedEx do and what they get. Better wages, working conditions, and benefits for the UPS Teamsters. Now, the Teamsters are doing some Amazon organizing. And, you know, we had Natalie Monteres on this podcast a couple months ago talking about, you know, the problems that they were having at the Staten Island Amazon hub, where they voted for union recognition and the company's stonewalling them. And, you know, she and others, there's now a lawsuit against the current leadership by, you know, a dissident faction. And they have, I think, a pretty good case. So it looks to me like, you know, the Teamsters are going to replace the Amazon labor union at Staten Island and some other hubs that I've been hearing about. So the question is, you know, how aggressive will the Teamsters be? And I don't think they'll be that aggressive unless, you know, the rank and file groups like Teamsters for a Democratic Union push the national union to make the a priority. But, you know, the situation's ripe. I mean, Amazon and FedEx, there's a lot of people that do a job in the uniform of the company, and they're not employees, they are independent contractors, which is a fiction. And it puts a lot of the burden on, you know, maintaining vehicles on these independent contractors. So there's good reason to, you know, get under a union contract, be an employee, get your benefits, and get better wages and working conditions. So I think there's an opportunity there. And, you know, hopefully, you know, people who want to get active in the labor movement, that's, if I was young and wanted to do that, I would get into, they call it salting. You know, I would work with the Teamsters and I'd salt probably an Amazon hub and start organizing there. So anyway, I don't want to talk the whole time, so let's open it up to questions and comments. Vicki Corden, I read on Yahoo News that libraries in Texas are being turned into disciplinary centers. It could spread to other states. Your thoughts? I think you're saying disciplinary. I hadn't seen that. I mean, what I have read about is how they're basically banning books in libraries, you know, good books, classic books, even Mark Twain books, because they say there's things in there that are offensive or young people can't handle, or they're sexual or they're racial. And one thing about Mark Twain, he did use the N-word. It was in the vernacular of the time he was writing in the quotes. So that's being realistic. But he was a staunch anti-racist. Pudd'nhead Wilson is a short story that, if people don't believe me, should read. It's about two babies. One is light-skinned black, the other is a white baby, and they get switched at birth. And a light-skinned black person becomes a nasty white racist, and the black person becomes an enslaved person. And it just brings out the absurdity of all that. And that was, you know, Mark Twain in the second half of the 19th century doing that. So that really concerns me. Now, I'm not sure. I mean, is it just physically that they're taking the library space and turning them from libraries into discipline spaces? So I'm not sure how to answer that, but if that's what they're doing, it's crazy. It's school libraries. Yeah, but you're saying they're shutting down the library and turning them into disciplinary centers? So if you're sent to the principal's room, now you get sent to the library, but it's a disciplinary center? I mean, if that's what they're doing in Texas, yes, that's what's been reported. I mean, Texas, that the Republicans in Texas are really fascist. They have always been extremely right-wing. And, you know, what they're doing on the border and what they're doing with guns and what they're doing with abortion, I mean, and they're barely a majority. I mean, the Democrats are growing in Texas. And, you know, it'll pretty soon be a pretty competitive state. I mean, what's his name? O'Rourke? I forget his first name, but Beto O'Rourke is, you know, he's come close to governor and did decent at senator. So, you know, this may be the last hurrah for those fascists. Let's hope so. Because what they're doing is just, Oh man, I don't even know how to describe it. It's hard to believe it's happening in the 21st century, but it is. Response to the coup in Nigeria. Well, you know, I don't like to see militaries take over from elected governments. It's pretty much been universally condemned. I mean, even Russia and the United States agree on this one, but not Prigozhin of the, yeah, in Niger. But Prigozhin in the, who seems to somehow still be part of the Kremlin's power structure. He's just supposed to operate in Belarus now and in Africa. He likes it because, you know, Wagner Mercenaries, his private military company, are propping up military coups in Mali and Burkina Faso and the government of the Central African Republic. In return, Wagner gets concessions for minerals, you know, gold and copper and cobalt, as well as in the Central African Republic, timber. So they're clear-cutting rainforest there. That's you know, all I really know about it. You know, not that Niger was a model of participatory democracy, and it's got a difficult situation with these jihadi insurgents who, you know, some analysts say, you know, it's not so much the Islamic fundamentalism that's motivating them as their marginalization in the societies. These are, you know, countries in the Sahel we're talking about, where the Saharan desert has been encroaching. The pastoralists further north are losing grazing lands, so they're moving further south to the agricultural areas, and that's where a lot of this conflict is rooted in. Same thing in Sudan, where you had a military coup from, there was a revolution in 2019, and the people almost took power, but they ended up in a joint government situation, a coalition with the military, where the military was supposed to step down and lead to elections. And when that time came, the military took over and kicked the representatives of the civil society out. And now the military is split between the rapid support forces, which Prigozhin and the Wagner group has been closer to, and the regular military. And it's, you know, led to thousands of deaths, 2 million refugees. I mean, that whole region is a disaster area. And it seems like, you know, the chaos has spread to a greater degree in Niger. So, you know, what can we do? I think what the U.S. and, you know, the West can do is provide more humanitarian aid, really help these countries develop, forget the IMF-type loans, you know, just give them grants. And, you know, it should be conditioned on it not being used to abuse human rights and so forth. But, you know, what's at the root of a lot of this conflict, I think, is just extreme poverty and competition for very scarce resources, which of course climate change is making worse. So, you know, it's a difficult situation. I don't think the solution is primarily, if at all, you know, U.S. military forces fighting the jihadis. You know, in Niger, which was a former French colony, it was the French who were doing that. I believe they're still there. They got kicked out of Mali and Burkina Faso. And, you know, there's an anti-colonial sentiment. I did see, you know, some people in the streets in Niger praising the coup and you know, parading Russian flags, seeming to invite the Wagner group in. And so, I don't know, we'll have to see what happens. But it's a difficult situation, and it's hard to say, you know, what we can do to make it better. Nathaniel Gregory, what would be the best way to organize green socialist perspectives in places like Texas and Florida? Well, I think the best way is to build local Green Party chapters that are have that perspective, or at least that perspective is part of the discussion. I wouldn't make it a condition on people joining the Green Party local. It should, you know, be a place where people that want to be independent and the left, to the left and progressive, should join the Green Party. We want all those people. And then we can talk about why we need an eco-socialist perspective as opposed to just a, you know, reform of capitalism perspective, like, you know, Bernie and the squad, even though they call themselves socialists in practice. You know, they're not Bernie's, but the Green New Deal that AOC and Markey put forward is, you know, it's neoliberal. It's all about incentives that I was talking about earlier, you know, tax breaks and subsidies for corporations and tax credits for high-end consumers to build out renewables. But we need to do much more than that. We need to have public ownership and democratic planning. So anyway, I think, you know, what we need to do if the Green Party is going to have power, it's got to have strong locals where people are organized. They're not just talking to themselves, but talking in the community, running local candidates. So the broader public gets to know us and electing us to local offices where we show that we're responsible and do good things. And on that basis, we can expand the state level and then the House of Representatives. I think, you know, it's a matter of organizing locals that know how to maintain themselves. You know, it's not just about going out to the latest demonstration, but it's about canvassing the community. It's about internal education. It's about socializing so people like hanging out with each other. And the Green Party's, you know, a better place to go than, you know, to a bar or something or whatever, you know, or sitting at home, probably worse, sitting at home on the screens, you know, whether it's your TV or your computer. You know, I'm not saying none of that, but we should have places where we're talking face to face and thinking things through together. So the best way to organize green socialist perspectives in Texas, Florida, and anywhere is to build locals where you actually, you know, educate yourselves on that perspective, debate it. Different people, like in educational meetings, present a summary of what y'all read to get a discussion started. That gives people experience in public speaking. There's so much you can do, but if we're not doing that in our locals and we're just online, we're really not organizing and we're not creating the kind of movement, you know, with organized core that can, you know, bring those perspectives and get them implemented as policy at, you know, the state level and eventually the federal level. Amy L. Sachs. We'll try and register for the Green Party annual national meeting later on. That's in early August. Hope to see some of you there paying the reduced fee because El Cid needing a vet checkup. I guess that's a pet. And I also have a bad tooth, so dental bills. Yeah, life interferes. I will be doing a session on ranked choice voting and proportional representation with Linda Templin, who heads a statewide, you know, RCVPR reform group in Colorado. And they've had some recent successes. And Mike Feinstein, with whom I've written some stuff on, particularly the year before last, on the problems in the HR1 voting rights bill that would have eliminated. Well, at first, it would have made it really hard to get primary matching funds in the presidential election. It would have increased, what was it, fivefold the amount of money we have to raise in 20 states from 5,000 to 25,000. Yeah, it was basically because the Greens are the only ones left trying to use it. The Democrats and Republicans, it's not enough money for them. You get so much more money from the fat cats. And you can't take that public money. There are limits to how much you can take in private money, if you take that public money. So the Democrats, and then the second version of that bill, you're trying to eliminate it. So anyway, Mike has worked on this, and he ran for Secretary of State as a Green And this was his issue, you know, ranked choice voting in California. He ran as a Green. So the three of us will be making a presentation on ranked choice voting and proportional representation. So on the National Green Party website, I'm sure there's information going up and more soon. So, you know, that'll be something for people to check out. Strongflower. Hi, Howie. Just curious, which cities and states have you noticed within the last few years that seem to do well in both the job market, resources, and affordable living? I know some of the coastal cities. The job market is pretty good in the big cities compared to the rural areas. That's where it seems the, you know, the jobs aren't being created. And affordable living, you know, the problem is the jobs don't pay where the rent is lower. You know, my city of Syracuse is a rust belt post-industrial city. The factories left and people are now working for half or a third of what they used to. And, you know, these white collar services or pink collar services, you know, like fast food joints, restaurants, gas stations, you know, janitorial services at the hospitals and university, that kind of thing. And so the rent is pretty low here. To buy houses is amazingly low when I compare it to California or New York City. So it's kind of a trade-off from what I can see. You know, if you go to the areas that are quote-unquote depressed, where the wages are low and the jobs may be more scarce, the living's more affordable. It's just sort of that's the way the markets work. So, I can't point to any place that I'm aware of that's, you know, got, you know, good jobs and wages and low rents or housing costs. I'm sure there's differences city to city, but I haven't really looked at it closely. Nathaniel Gregory, is there an infrastructure agenda for eco-socialism in the municipal levels? What would it include? Well, I certainly think so. I think we should be talking about Green New Deals for our municipalities. And that would involve, I think, first of all, public power. If your local utility is not already publicly owned, that should be a campaign. It should be a platform plank. And if it is publicly owned, is it democratically controlled, or do you have to organize to get control of it? When you can do that, then you've got a real resource that can build renewables, phase out fossils, and can also finance, you know, for example, not just renewable electricity generation that the utility does, but financing retrofitting buildings, homes and businesses and et cetera for things like ground source heat pumps or just heat pumps that use air source so that you get off gas and into renewable. Now, the heat pumps are run by electricity, so you need renewably sourced electricity. So it is contributing, but it replaces gas. I mean, we have a Green New Deal not far from here, about 70 miles in Ithaca, New York. And they've done an inventory. You can probably go to the city website and find this. I've seen it in the papers where they've looked at each building in the city and assess what they need to get off gas and onto, you know, renewable heating and cooling. So that can be done. And then transportation, you know, improving public transportation infrastructure so we're not so dependent on the car, which is energy intensive and uses land inefficiently. Another thing is zoning. One of the things is you have in some areas exclusionary zoning. You know, everything has to be single family homes. And that leaves out multifamily, more affordable homes. And that leaves the class and race segregation. And that's a big issue. Right? It's here in New York. It was just a big issue in the Democratic primary in Arlington, Virginia, where they used proportional ranked choice voting to elect the two Democratic candidates. And it worked. The Democratic Party is divided there between those that want to keep the exclusionary zoning and those that want to go to inclusionary zoning. And both sides got one of the two candidates that goes to the general election. If it had been winner-take-all plurality, one side would have got all the representation, and the other side would have got none. So, but anyway, I'm saying, you know, zoning is another issue. And then you can integrate the transportation and the zoning so that if you're building affordable housing or even any new housing, you locate it near the public transportation corridors. And then you integrate that with, you know, more diversified zoning so you can have businesses close to residents, which creates jobs close to residents. Or there's so much you can do at the local level. So I've hit three: energy, transportation, and housing. I think those are the big three, but there's certainly more that can be done. Via email, comments on Israel's passage of a law weakening their Supreme Court. Yeah, they're basically creating, breaking down what separation of powers there is. There isn't much between the legislative and executive because it's a parliamentary system, which I actually like because I think it's more accountable to the, you know, the elected representatives and the legislative side. But this is, you know, creating autocracy. It's really divided Israeli society. Unfortunately, they're not divided so much on the terrible treatment of Palestinians and the expansion of Israel and the settlements into Palestinian land, which is a whole nother question. But it's definitely a move to the right, and it's creating fissures in Israeli society. It'll be interesting to see if the resistance remains and there'll be a backlash against this law, which the far right is pushing. So you get another government in Israel soon that is not so extreme to the right. That may be one consequence, but it's an anti-democratic law. Kim O'Connor, I just came on, so maybe you addressed all Cornel West issues already. No, we haven't. But I would like to know where he is registered to vote. When did he register Green? Did he register People's Party before switching to presidential ambitions? What was he registered before then? I sent these questions to him without a response. I have asked several political reporters in Florida, and they don't know. I asked Kathy Gilbert of Miami, who helped in Jill Stein facilitation of him coming to Greens. Okay, well, what do I know? Keep it up there. There were a lot of questions. I can't remember that all in my head. What state is he registered in? He lives in Harlem in New York City, so I assume he's registered in New York. I was disappointed to read recently that in 2020, he was publicly supporting Biden. And then he said he couldn't vote for him, so he didn't vote for anybody. And, you know, I was on the ballot. We needed votes to keep our ballot line, which I lost. And Cornell, I told him that at the time, but maybe he forgot, but disappointed to read that. So I think he's registered in New York. Did he register Green? I expect he's probably done that by now. I don't know for sure, but I'm sure he will because he wants the Green nomination. I think he was probably registered Democratic because he supported Bernie Sanders. And he couldn't have registered People's Party in New York because it doesn't have a ballot line. And they do have a little group here, or did. But, you know, they're really a non-factor. So if he wrote in People's Party on his registration card, he's going to have to change it again to Green Party. What was he registered before then? Well, I think he was registered Democratic. I assume so he could vote for Sanders in primaries. And, you know, he supported Barack Obama and 2008, he supported Al Sharpton. In 2004, he supported Bill Bradley. In 2000, these are in the primaries. So I think he's probably been a registered Democrat. I don't know if he ever, even when he supported Jill Stein in 2016 or Ralph Nader in 2000, I doubt he switched his registration. Don't know, but he mostly supported Democrats, you know, the last 24 years that I'm aware of who he supported. Political reporters in Florida, you know, national political reporters, you know, that's a question. And then you sent questions to him, I guess his website, without response. The campaign's coming together. I guess it's not all together because they should give, you know, quick responses to queries like that. So that's what I know, Kim. So I'm sure answers to these questions will be pretty clear soon, because he's, you know, the registration question, he's got to register green. If he doesn't, the Greens are not going to nominate him. They're just going to say he's not serious about us. Violet at Content Boutique. Howie, do you think we may turn into a nocturnal society as this heat progresses? I've never thought of that. I mean, some things you got to do during the day, you know, mowing lawns, landscaping, construction. I guess you can do at night with a lot of lights, but that's a lot more energy. I think we're turning in more to a society where most work is done indoors, you know, computers, you know, passing information around, or, you know, in production facilities, factories that are, you know, a lot of it's automation, a lot of it is, you know, computer controlled machines, but it's still indoors. And I'm thinking now at the UPS hub, while they got fans and eventually air conditioning in the driver's trucks, they did say they're going to put more fans in the hubs. In Syracuse, we didn't have any fans. And, you know, I talked to UPS workers that had, you know, worked down south where they did have fans. And, you know, they didn't like it so much because it kicked up all the dust. You get so much box dust anyway that, you know, it just makes the air, you know, not as good. So fans are a mixed blessing. Air conditioning would be nice. It's very expensive in a big warehouse structure. But there again, you know, heat pumps, whether ground source. In case of a big hub, you probably want a big ground source heat pump, which would also warm the building in winter, which is another issue. I mean, I got frostbite on the tip of one of my toes during one of those polar vortexes one year, unloading a rail car, you know, steel bottom, and it just like sucked the heat right out of us. So, you know, I'm bundled up, I'm sweating in my upper body, but the tips, my fingers and toes were freezing. So, you know, to have a warmer hub in the winter and a cooler hub in the summer would be nice. But that isn't in the contract. A lot of the work they do at UPS, you know, the trucks, the packages are delivered during the day, but they're sorted a lot at night. So that's an industry where a lot of people, you know, work second shift or graveyard shift, third shift. So I don't know. That's an interesting question. I don't think we're going to go completely nocturnal, but for people that don't have to work, I mean, it's cooler in the evening when the sun is not out. So people may spend more time awake then and more time sleeping when it's hot. Response to Russia pulling out of the grain deal. I think it's mean-spirited. You know, they're trying to get their wheat out there with higher prices. You know, Putin said he's going to send, what did he say, 50,000 tons, I think, to five African countries for free. which is a drop in the bucket when you realize hundreds of millions of tons of grain are shipped. And then they not only, said they're going to attack grain barges, taking grain out of Ukraine, which effectively sets up a blockade. They started bombing the port infrastructure and the grain warehouses in Odessa and Mykolaiv and I think it's called Kramatorsk, another port city a little south of Odessa. And then they even bombed a grain storage facility and export facility in Reni on the Danube River, which is on the border with Romania. So that bomb landed 200 meters from Romania, which is a NATO country. And Russian missiles aren't always so accurate. That could have hit Romania. So I think, what Russia's doing is a real problem. And he met with African leaders, and 43 were invited. Only 17 or 19 showed up. And from the reporting, it's a 2 or 3 day event and it ended yesterday. And from the reporting I've seen so far is that these African leaders, who are the ones closest to Russia, were urging Putin to get back in the grain deal because Africa in particular is going to be hurt by it. Just the fact that Ukrainian grain is now off the market has raised prices. Ukraine has said in retaliation they may go after grain, Russian grain shipments. That's not off limits to them. I'm not sure they'll do that. They got these surface drones that are, that got part of the Kerch Bridge. It's hit some of the Ukrainian military ships. I think they'll use those for military targets. It would not be good for Ukraine, politically to hit Russian grain. They should be saying our grain should be able to get out too. But I think it's terrible on the whole. And I hope there is still negotiations going on. Russia's playing hardball, but I think, even China's upset with them. China told Russia before, don't pull out, because a third of Ukraine's grain from last year went to China. And then Putin says he's crazy, lies. He says only 3% of Ukraine's grain went to developing countries. But the World Food Program, which took a lot of that grain, said, I think it said 65% of the grain went to developing countries. Now, I don't know if that includes China, but, a substantial portion, and that they provided a major portion of the grain for the World Food Program's a crisis program dealing with the Horn of Africa, Somalia, Kenya, South Sudan, that are, facing hunger and near starvation. The grain deal, was an indication that, Russia and Ukraine, even if through intermediaries like Turkey, were still communicating. We get that from the POW swaps. It's going to have to happen if there's ever a settlement to this war. And but pulling out of the grain deal is just an escalation of the conflict on Russia's part. And it's an attack on the hundreds of millions of people in the global south that need that grain. I think it's hurting, Russia politically and world opinion, and including with countries that have tried to stay out of it. 35 countries, many of them in Africa, have abstained from the resolutions condemning Russia's invasion and then its annexation of territories in Ukraine. But this may push them away from Russia. So, I don't know what's going on in the Russian elite. I mean, generals are disappearing, Prigozhin, stages of mutiny, and now he seems to be walking freely. He's back and forth between Russia and Belarus. There was a report I just saw on BBC that 100 Wagner mercenaries are headed toward the Polish border. Not like 100 people can invade Poland, but what is that, some kind of provocation? It's not a good situation. And the pulling out of the grain deal just made it worse. Okay, we have run out of time. It always goes faster than I think. I'm just looking at some of the notes. I didn't get a chat. I can't read the chat while we're talking, so I will have to read it after, but I see some interesting things I want to read. So, well, thanks for being here today. I laid out a whole bunch of problems, and, you know, the fact that we need a progressive independent party on the left in this country. We're practically the only country in the world that doesn't have that. That's a multi-party democracy, which, of course, is what we need. That's where ranked choice voting and particularly proportional representation through proportional ranked choice voting for multi-member districts is such an important demand for us to push, because that'll open up the political system. So, you know, and like I said, in answer to one of those questions, we can't do this unless we have an organized base. That means all of us need to be, you know, building our locals and bringing in people at that level. So, as I said at the top, next week we're going to have Rafael Bernabe, and he is a senator in Puerto Rico, elected with the Progressive Third Party Citizens Victory Movement. He's done a lot of work on Ukraine solidarity. Oh, I got it. Thank you. Rafael is in 2 weeks, the 12th. I've been having a lot of communication with him, so I got the dates mixed up. So, yeah, let's correct that. We'll have Rafael in 2 weeks. Next week, we'll have Svetlana Romanko, who was the representative of 350.org and a climate activist in Ukraine, who made the headlines in the last COP, Conference of Parties of the UN climate summits, where she told the Russians off, you know, who were invading her country and, you know, being a petro state. And she got escorted out of the conference, but she made her point. And now she runs a group called Razum We Stand. Razum means together in Ukrainian. And it's about, you know, strengthening the sanction on Russian oil and gas, and moving away from these authoritarian petro states, and pushing a green reconstruction of Ukraine post-war, you know, centered around renewable energy. So she's going to be here. She's in Ukraine. You know, like most Ukrainians, she's had, you know, friends and relatives become victims of Russian aggression. So, you know, she's the real deal. And so she will be here next week, and I'm looking forward to it. And so that's why I'm not going to talk so much about issues, because I knew next week I had a guest who was important. So both Svetlana Romanko next week and then Rafael Bernabe the week after are going to be very interesting guests. And so I hope you all be there. And meanwhile, have a good week. Stay cool in this extreme heat. And, you know, stay strong. Take care.